Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and today we're talking not about an episode, we're talking about another book, a very new book. This time it's the turn of Cammy Garcia's brand new The X-Files Origins, Agent of Chaos. So this is another journey into the world of written fiction, and I'm joined by a writer, one of the authors from IDW's Secret Agenda's X-Files anthology from last year. It's a real pleasure to have on Mr. George Ivanov. Now, have I said your surname right, George?
It's actually Ivanov, but close enough.
Do you know what? It was a 50-50, and I chose wrong.
That is not a problem.
Thank you ever so much for coming on, George. All the way from Melbourne, I believe, in Australia?
That's right, yes. It's just after 8 a.m. here at the moment.
Wow. It's currently just after 9 p.m. here in England. So this is probably my biggest time difference I've ever done with anyone.
not had an Aussie on your show yet.
No, this is, again, a first as well. So you're technically in the future from a country you've never had on the show before. So you're ticking two boxes there, George. That's amazing.
But that's kind of cool.
So as I say, you're a writer yourself, and we're going to talk about your contribution to Secret Agendas towards the end of the podcast, because you've written one of the, and I'm not just saying that this because you're on, genuinely one of the best stories in that anthology. I really mean this.
Thank you very much.
Before that, though, do you want to tell us a little bit about your writing itself? Before we get started, before we go into the five questions of X, what is it you're mainly known for writing, and what is it that you're working on right now?
Right, okay. Well, I'm a children's author. Mostly, I've spent years writing for the education market here, which means, you know, things like school readers and non-fiction books for classroom study and primary school, stuff like that. And also, you know, science fiction and fantasy for kids. So the books that I'm most known for at the moment here in Australia are the You Choose books, which are kind of my take on the old Choose Your Own Adventure novels.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. They're great.
I was a huge fan of those as a kid. So when I had the opportunity to pitch a new series like that to my publisher, I grabbed it. So, yeah, that's been a lot of fun. So mostly stuff for kids, occasionally stuff for young adults, and occasionally stuff for grown-ups.
You've got a cross-section of the market there, George. You're covering all the bases.
Yeah, and well, yeah, I'm also a bit of a fanboy with shows, you know, like X-Files and Star Trek and Doctor Who and stuff. So any time I get the opportunity to write something in that area, I kind of grab it.
I bet, absolutely. And as I say, we'll talk about how you got into Secret Agendas towards the end of the podcast. But before we do, speaking of your fandom, let's talk about the five questions of X, which I do, as everyone knows, with new guests who come on the show, and to gauge your X-Files fandom. So my first question is, when and how did you first discover the X-Files?
Right at the beginning, when it first showed here on Australian television. So I'm not sure what the difference would have been between when it showed in the States and Britain and Australia. Back then, we used to get things fairly late compared to the rest of the world. So I'm guessing it would have been at least 6 months or so after everybody else.
That's roughly when we got it, actually. That's about roughly. I think it's between 6 months and a year, probably.
Well, that's what usually happened in Australia with stuff back in the 90s. But I also remember there being quite a buzz about X-Files at the time. It was a big event. It was Channel 10 that showed it here. And I remember there was a lot of advertising beforehand that this amazing new series was coming, and I saw the ads and thought, oh yes, this is the sort of thing I'm gonna like.
Yeah, and then a love affair was born.
Yeah, I pretty much watched it religiously in the first few years, and then I did eventually start to lose track of it. I think a lot of people did. I know a lot of other fans here, friends of mine who were like me. They loved all the early series, all the early seasons, and then kind of tapered off as it went along. Because, I mean, my favorite episodes of X-Files are usually the standalones, not the ones that got into all the conspiracy mythology. So, and I think as the show went along, they concentrated more on the conspiracy mythology part of it and less on the the Monster of the Week program.
They did, especially towards the last few seasons, especially season 8, which was a very it was a very mythology heavy season, really. At least half of it was mythology, so that's true. Well, speaking of the fact that you love standalone episodes and things like that, what would you say your favorite episode of the show is, if you could pin one down?
Well, if I had to pin it down, it's the one that I have problems actually pronouncing.
There could be many. There could be quite a lot of them.
I'm not 100% sure of the pronunciation, but War of the Coprophages, is that how you pronounce it?
I think you're on the right lines there. Because for years I used to say War of the Coprophages when I was younger, which is completely wrong.
Well, I simply refer to it as that cockroach episode.
Yeah. That's the best way of describing it. I think it's War of the Coprophages or War of the Coprophages, something like that. So you're on the right lines, George, yeah.
But yes, I did like that episode because, again, it did all the things that I really liked. You know, it was the standalone monster episode. It was the is it real or isn't it sort of thing. It, you know, you had the real division between the way Mulder and Scully approached it, and it also had a little bit of humor, and I liked it when X-Files did a bit of humor.
Yeah, it was always at its best. The Darren Morgan episodes and that he wrote, which that's the one he likes the least, actually, but I really like that one. I think it's a great episode, so it's a good choice, and they're always great fun. So that's season 3, that one. Would you say that season 3 is your favourite season if you had to pin it down, or would you come up with another one? If
I had to actually pin it down, I would say it would be season 1. It was, I guess, when... And look, and part of that is probably nostalgia, because it was when The X-Files was most exciting for me, because it was new. And it's season 1 is also fairly fresh in my mind at the moment, too, because I rewatched it. Or when I wrote the Secret Agenda story, because I decided to set that story during the course of season 1. So I rewatched the whole of season 1 and, in fact, was quite amazed by how well the show stands up. You know, a lot of shows from that era don't stand up so well to rewatching now, but I was very impressed with the way that stood up. Yeah, so rewatching all of that and then having, you know, the event series... Which I watched and absolutely loved, and since I loved rewatching the first season and I loved the later season, I then went to my local DVD store and have now bought the entire thing on DVD, and I'm shortly going to start making my way through seasons 2 to 9.
Oh, a great journey you're going to go on there. A nice revisit of something. Cause I'm guessing it's been a while since you did the full run of the season.
Yes.
Of the series.
Yeah. Well, I've never done a complete rewatch. Since the original screening, I've only done the sort of like watch the, you know, the occasional episode, like going back and watching some of my favourites.
Oh, you're in for a treat. You're going to love it.
I've heard a lot of people say that the latter seasons hold up better now than they did back then. So it'll be interesting to watch it now.
Yeah, season 8 especially is a lot better than people remember it at the time. Because they were struggling with, you know, the fact David Duchovny had half left the show and things. But it really holds up well. Yeah, so... No, it's good. You have to keep us posted on that, George, and how you get on with it on that rewatch, because it's great. If you were to try and pin down a favourite character then my next question, who would that be? Now, it doesn't have to just be Mulder and Scully. It could be anyone. It could be a support character. But who would yours be?
Oh, look, without a doubt, Scully. You know, and that's partly probably because I had a bit of a crush on her when she first showed up. But I thought she was a terrific character, and I think she's just so well... acted as well, so well brought to life on the screen. Then again, you know, David Duchovny does so with Mulder as well. One of the interesting things of doing the rewatch of season 1 was just seeing how much subtlety there was in both their performances. especially with the humour.
Yeah, they both had their own unique ways of twisting a line to be quite funny and dry and things like that in a very different way. But yeah, I mean, it's funny, the amount of people, I've said this before on the show, the amount of people who say Scully when I ask this question is far more than any other character. And I completely understand why, because she is such a brilliant character. And I think the longer I'm a fan of the show and the more I watch it back, she's more of mine now as well. I think it's, she is the standout. It's not the X-Files without Scully.
But you know, having said that, with the new event series, I really, really did like Agent Einstein as well.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. But then again, I also like Lauren Ambrose. I think she's a terrific actor.
I think people struggled with those two because they weren't particularly in the greatest episodes. I think if they had better episodes, they might stick out a bit more, Miller and Einstein. But we'll see if we get a season 11. Fingers crossed.
Yes. After season 11, I still have, you know, that hope that the two of them might get their spin-off series.
You never know. If as many people like them as you, it's entirely, stranger things have happened. Finally then, for the five questions of X, what would you say your favourite moment from the entire series has been? Is there a scene or just something that flashes up?
That is really, really hard, because there are so many like iconic moments, like the first time that you see Tomb stretch and stuff. But there are things that stick in my mind from War of the Whatever's, War of the Cockroaches. Can I call it War of the Cockroaches?
Yeah, do that. It's much easier.
You know, Scully on the phone saying, "Bambi, her name is Bambi." I love that moment. And from the new series, it would definitely be Mulder's little magic mushroom trip. I adore that scene, especially when they break into Achy Breaky Heart with the boot scooting.
You see, that I'll be honest, I'll be completely honest with you, George. I wasn't a big fan of it, but I've only watched it once. Ah. And Babylon is that episode is one of the big, it's become a running joke really amongst the X-Cast fan community and everything, in that Babylon is the one that divides everybody. There's as many people who love Babylon as hate Babylon. So I need to go back and watch it again.
Yeah,
because it's a polarizing scene. But
as I said, I like it when they put in a bit of humor, and yeah, just that scene was just, I absolutely loved it.
Oh, awesome. Good choices. Well, that's brilliant. That's the five questions of X then. That's a real great gauge of your fandom, and some wonderful picks there. So now that's finished, let's move on to the meat of the episode, and we'll start talking about the X-Files Origins Agent of Chaos. So Agent of Chaos is the new book by Cami Garcia, which was published on the 3rd of January by Atom Books. And it's a prequel, probably the first major prequel the show has ever done, certainly in book form anyway. So it's all centered around Mulder, Fox Mulder, when he's in his late teens in 1979, and he's drawn into a quite disturbing murder mystery involving children who are disappearing, which ends up leading back not just to his unresolved feelings about his sister Samantha, but potentially the entire government conspiracy that he ends up chasing all his life.
Yes. I thought it was interesting the way she decided to bring in the whole conspiracy thing and yet keep it reasonably under control. How do I put this? The book isn't an X-Files conspiracy mythology book as such. It's got elements of it in there, but the actual, you know, murder mystery, I guess, that Mulder is solving is, you know, a case in itself with that mythology kind of around the edges.
Yeah, it is a book that is centered around a murder mystery with lots of extra elements that connect back for X-Files fans. Before we go on, I will just put in a spoiler warning at this point. We're going to talk about the book, everybody. We're going to talk about the details. We're going to talk about the characters. We're going to talk about the plot choices. So if you haven't read Agent of Chaos and you want to be completely unspoiled going into this. Stop now, go away and read, and we'll say hello when you come back having read the book. So off you go. Bye-bye.
And do go away and read it, because I'll say now, it's a really good book. I really enjoyed both it and Devil's Advocate. I thought that was really good too.
Well, everyone, you're back now. Hello, welcome back. You've read the book. That was quick. So now you're back with us. George, you as you say, you like the book. What would you give it out of 10 then? Let's give it a rating like we do the episodes.
Oh, goodness, I hate rating things. I really hate things.
Sorry about this.
You know, 10 would just be so, you know, brilliantly exceptional that I rarely give anything a 10. I'd probably give it an 8, you know, saving the, you know, 9 and 10 for, you know, mind-blowing stuff.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. 8 is a barometer of real quality. I would completely agree. Why would you give it an 8?
Right, because first of all, as an X-Files book, it works really well as an X-Files book in that it's believably Mulder. You get a lot of background to his character. Things fit in with the X-Files mythology. It just really works as an X-Files book, but it also works as a standalone. You know, I actually don't think you need to be an X-Files fan to read and understand this book. It works in and of itself as a terrific kind of procedural murder mystery solving story with really interesting characters.
Definitely. It's got a real blend, because obviously it's not a traditional X-File in the sense that it's Mulder and Scully investigating a case. I mean, first off, Scully's not even in the book, because this is, as everyone knows, this is meant for the young adult market. It's a young adult book, which you've got Agent of Chaos, which is telling the Mulder story by Cammy Garcia, and then Jonathan Maybury, who was also involved in the creation of the whole thing, who was interviewed about this on the show a few weeks ago, as listeners will remember, wrote Devil's Advocate, which you mentioned earlier, George, which is all about Scully's origin around the same time. So this is separate. This is a Mulder prequel. And having that focus on Mulder, I think, really allows them sort of to drill down into the kind of story, really, that is appropriate for Mulder. I mean, that's what I got from it. It was a really Mulder kind of story, I thought.
What I thought was really interesting about the two books is almost how they slightly flip things, in that Scully got the overtly supernatural sort of story, and Mulder got the more procedural murder mystery story. I thought that was really interesting, and you kind of get the background then as to why each of them went in the direction they went afterwards of believer and skeptic. And I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I'll confess, I haven't read Devil's Advocate yet. I'm saving that for
an episode
we're going to do.
I'm not allowed to give you spoilers here.
Well, if you could try and talk about it without spoiling too many major plot points, I would be grateful.
The only thing that I really wanted to say in that case about Devil's Advocate is I liked the way that you had that slight little bit of crossover in that in Agent of Chaos, Mulder and his friends end up visiting the town of Krager, which is where Scully lives.
I see that now. That's interesting. That's very interesting.
They don't meet her or anything. They meet other characters who are important in Devil's Advocate.
Now, that's that kind of intertextuality that if I'd have read both books already, I'd have picked up on.
I had to read both books. I couldn't just leave it at the one. They work well together. I think they work really well together. I would highly recommend people like read them one after the other.
Well, this is it. I would have done in any other. I've got them both, and I would have done in any other circumstance. But we're recording a podcast on Devil's Advocate in around a month. I want to read it a bit fresher, closer to the recording. So I'm saving Devil's Advocate for a few weeks' time, and then I'm going to really get into it and enjoy it. But otherwise, yeah, I think if you don't have to do that, guys, and you know, you're just going to buy them, do it as George has done it, because I think you'll pick up even more of those things. I think what Cammy Garcia has done a really good job with is making it, as I say, a very Mulder story, but obviously not forgetting that her market is teenagers, really, that she's writing for young children. And I think, as you're a children's author, George, I'm sure you got even more out of that as somebody who writes children's fiction. I'm sure you could see what she was trying to really
accomplish. Oh, look, indeed. And I've got to say, I was actually surprised by the choice of writing these two books as young adult novels. I really wasn't certain there would be a market for it amongst young adults, big, because, you know, X-Files was a long time ago, and I would have assumed that most of the fans were all grown-ups these days. So I was surprised by that choice. But, you know, I believe they're both doing really, really well, so it was obviously a good choice. But, yes, I thought it worked really well as a young adult story, in that you get a lot of Mulder's life as a teenager, and you get the traditional elements of a young adult story, in that, you know, you've got his relationship with his parents, particularly with his father, his relationship with his friends, the whole thing of him being a little bit of an outsider, and, you know, that his two best friends are even more geeky than he is, and stuff. So that I think that works really well. What Cammy does really well also is get into the head of a teenage boy. I thought that worked really well. And, you know, his Farrah Fawcett poster on the back of his door and stuff like that. It's just, so you have, I guess what, you know, aside from the young adult element and the getting into the head of the teenage boy, you also had a really amazing sense of time and place. You know, the fact that it was a Farrah Fawcett poster on the back of the wall and stuff like that. It's great. I thought she did a real good job of that.
You got a real sense. You did get a real sense of time and location. And yeah, it does all the things I think young adult books are supposed to do really well. You know, you mentioned a few of them, like, you know, the fact he's got this fractious relationship with his dad, the fact he's got burgeoning, you know, sexual urges and feelings, certainly towards the character of Phoebe. And he's, like in a lot of teen fiction, there's a central romance and a difficult teenage romance of misunderstood feelings and, you know, Mulder. But what I liked was that it's all Mulder. You know, he's still the same guy. He Mulder, even when he's an adult, has a difficult relationship with his parents. Even when he's an adult, he can't really function around women normally, you know, to the point he has a porn addiction. And the only woman he really can function around ends up being Scully, which is... And Phoebe, in many respects, is almost like a proto-Scully. So it's interesting in that sense. So it was all very Mulder. It still felt like the character that we know.
Yes, it did.
He's just 10, 15 years younger.
Yes, I was very impressed with the author's ability to take that established character and take him back into time and make him believable and make him recognisably Mulder, while also making him a teenage boy, which we've never actually seen in the series. So yeah. I thought she did that really well.
She's covering an area in his life that we don't know much about, really, from the TV show. You know, we saw, and we see them in the book, the flashbacks to when Samantha was abducted. We see them at various points across the show, when he's, like in the episode Little Green Men, when we see the flashback, and then in Demons when he's trying to recall and he's got these really disturbing memories or possible memories of what happened. But he's always the young boy. He's always the 12-year-old boy or 13-year-old boy, however old he was. We've never seen the teenage Mulder coming of age, coming to understand who he is, coming to understand what he wants to do with his life. And this book, in a relatively short running time, manages to do all of it, you know, which really impressed me.
Yeah, as I said right at the beginning, it works really well as both X-Files and as a standalone. I think it's, very impressive.
I think you hit that on the head when you said that, actually, that it works as a standalone story. I think you can come into it with, you know, no real knowledge of the X-Files. And as you say, a lot of the young people won't have any knowledge. It will be their parents telling them, oh, the X-Files was a good show, read this.
I guess that's easier with a prequel like this than it would be with, you know, something set during the run of the show or a sequel. Because, well, we as X-Files fans, as you said, are unfamiliar with the character at this stage of their lives. So it is kind of all new and fresh. So it's, I guess, a little bit easier to make it more standalone. I mean, having said that, you know, you don't need to be an X-Files fan to come to this book, but if you are an X-Files fan, there are so many nice little nods and little things. You know, the appearance of, you know, the smoking man in X, I thought that was very nice. They work here as, like, mystery characters and what have you, but as to a fan of the series, you immediately go, oh, yes, okay. this is great. True. This is, you know, like their first, you know, working together. It's good. I like that. I like that element. I like having those little moments of going, oh, yes.
And there were so many of them in here. I mean, the X one is really interesting because what she does with X is actually give him some backstory. We get a name for a start. His name is Reggie. And before he's christened X by the Smoking Man. And we also get the idea that he had a drunken, abusive father. And he came from quite a disturbing, you know, childhood background. Because one thing in the TV show they always hinted at with X, which we'll talk about much more in the podcast as we go along in the show, but they hint that the idea that X, in many respects, used to be Mulder in many ways. Before he was, you know, brought into the conspiracy, X went through a similar journey. And I think having him be from a home which is broken with a father that he didn't get on with, like Mulder, even makes that parallel even more interesting, really, as well as placing X at a point where he's always been looking out and watching Mulder and keeping him safe from the sidelines.
Mm.
It was great. It was a great load of callbacks, wasn't it, to that relationship?
Although I suppose, you know, the implication being that X killed his own father is kind of sets him apart a little bit.
Well, yeah, in the end. And that's, I think, the difference, isn't it, you know, between them, which is why Mulder never went down that path and never became X.
Yeah, because X is shown to be quite the cold-blooded killer there.
Were you a bit chilled by that? Because at the end, when he kills the Major, I was... Yeah.
I liked the Major. I thought he was such a great character. I was so sorry to see him snuff it.
I know. I thought they were setting him up to be like a recurring...
Yeah.
Because they're talking about doing more books. I thought he'd be recurring sort of eccentric foil for Mulder and stuff. But yeah, it was a bit of a punch, wasn't it, when he was killed?
It was. And I think that's the point for a death like that to actually mean something. You've got to really care about the character. And damn it, she made me care about him and then killed him.
Definitely. Assuming we're going to get a sequel, which I think everyone wants to do, it puts Gimble in a different position, doesn't it? When we pick up on this, you know, he's lost his father now.
Yes, and that was my next thought after the, oh no, they killed him! My next thought was, if they do another book, what's going to happen to Gimble? How's he going to handle this? And how is that going to affect his friendship with Mulder?
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that from here on in, we might get, you know, the whole aliens conspiracy thing. I can just see Mulder and Gimble going through like a secret stash of the Major's notes or something that had been found and about the alien, alien conspiracy, and seeing it taking off from there.
It's a little bit Stranger Things. I don't know if you saw that show on Netflix.
I loved that.
It was great. And I could totally see Mulder, Gimble, Phoebe, maybe any other young person who's added into the mix, it being a bit of a Stranger Things kind of scenario where they're looking into strange and weird things as teenagers. I think that would be ace, really. Going into the 80s, I think that'd be really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I liked Gimble. I thought Gimble was a good... He was a bit of a lone gunman prototype as well,
yes,
in a way. You could imagine him being one of them.
Yes, yes indeed. So yeah, I suppose so. So we've got teenage Mulder and a teenage version of a lone gunman,
like Frohickey. Like he had that sort of slightly pervy approach that Frohickey has.
The way he was always watching Phoebe.
yeah, checking out her ass, things like that. Which it's like Frohickey looking at Scully, going, "She's hot." It's that kind of stuff. I love that. And I think they work really well as a trio, those three. I think, you know, Mulder with being the kind of, you know, laid-back straight man that he is. You've got Gimble being the comic foil, comic relief. And then you've got Phoebe as the, you know, the traditional kind of perfect geek chick, I guess, you know, from that kind of fiction.
And the voice of reason to a large extent, too. sort of like, no, don't go in there. It's going to be dangerous. No, he's a serial killer. You don't walk up to a serial killer.
Yeah, she's like our voice, because there's several points, isn't there, where Mulder is doing the Mulder thing, and he's taking those leaps of logic for the first time almost, and he's saying, right, well, it's obviously Earl Roy. We've got to go and find him so we can save this girl. And she's going, what? Wait a minute. Yeah, we need to call the cops. He's like, no, we've got to go there. We've got to do this. And that, again, is a very... It's like the later Mulder and Scully relationship where Mulder's going, it's obviously this Scully. We need to go and do this Scully. And she's like, hang on, Mulder. And it's that reflection already. It's that kind of woman that Mulder always goes for. And I thought that was really clever in that even his teenage romance was effectively an early version of Scully. I thought that was great. And interesting she's called Phoebe, given that his first real sort of grown-up love is supposed to be Phoebe Green, who was the Scotland Yard detective from the episode Fire. I don't know if you remember her.
Oh, only vaguely.
I'm going full-on fan here. Yeah. Basically, she...
Yeah, I'm afraid you're out-fanning me.
I'm sorry, George. But in the episode Fire, which was season one, we see Phoebe and she was with him at Oxford. And they're very much... She's like he's Irene Adler if he's Sherlock Holmes. And they do a lot of little winks to that in the episode. And I think the Oxford years is something that Cammy Garcia or Jonathan Maybury might well do one day if we get there.
Oh, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
That would be really good. Because, I mean, at the end...
I'd read that.
Yeah, me too. And at the end, it sort of suggests it, doesn't it? You know, by the fact that Mulder decides that, you know...
It's definitely going there rather than where his dad wants him to go, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when the FBI guy outside goes, well, obviously he's up, you've got to go to Oxford. And he's like, So, maybe. But I think, what did you think of the relationship between Mulder and Phoebe? Do you think it really works well as a...
Oh, as a teen sort of almost romance that doesn't quite get there. Yes, I think it works very well. Because, look, I mean, teenage years are a very confusing time in life. And, you know, all these, you know, sort of feelings that you haven't had before and stuff. And not knowing how to articulate it all and stuff. She really does capture that very well with Mulder and Phoebe. I think it works, and you know, as a grown-up reader, you're reading this, and you're almost screaming at Mulder. It was just tell her, and then you think back to what you were like as a teenager, and no, I understand him not telling it because there's no chance in hell I would have either. But
totally, the amount of times I can look back and think, oh my God, why didn't I say something then? Why didn't I make a move then? Why am I being so painfully awkward at this point? And yeah, I look back on my younger self and think, oh my God, Tony, what were you doing? And this is the thing. It's very accurate in that sense. It just does read off the page really well. And I liked Phoebe when she could have become a little bit of a too good to be true kind of character. I liked the fact that she really gave as good as she got, and she didn't give Mulder any, you know, any quarter. She was a real match for him, and I thought that was terrific. And with Gimble in the middle, it was great. But I also liked the way they used Bill Mulder as well. Because, again, we haven't really seen him in this sort of context either. We've only seen flashbacks to a young Bill Mulder involved in the conspiracy over the course of the show, and we've seen him as an old man when he was out of the conspiracy, and he was trying to, you know... Well, he left it because he couldn't cut... deal with what he was doing anymore. We've never seen the guy having to deal with a teenage Mulder who is rebellious, who doesn't want to follow his path. And I thought that was really good. He's the traditional sort of angry, frustrated father, isn't he? Single father at this point.
Yes, he is. And there's also that element of him, you know, obviously being much more wrapped up in his job than he is in the lives of his family. Which I guess is another trope of young adult writing, young adult stories, that idea of the parent who's more concerned with their career than with their family, and you know the teenager then having to deal with that.
And it's even more difficult when your father is part of a conspiracy of men trying to bring on an alien apocalypse.
That makes it takes it to the next level, doesn't it?
And There were lots of little hints as well at the fact that he's involved in that. You know, there were things I look like the fact he's going to New Mexico or when he's on the phone. And there are little things that, I mean, I love the detail. There are little things like he mentions, there's one point where he's on the phone and he's, Mulder only hears fragments of the conversation. And he says words like merchandise, which is from the Anasazi trilogy. Or he mentions Openshaw, who was one of the doctors who we only ever saw in the sixth season in like one episode, who was burned alive by the Smoking Man in the end, who was involved in making the alien-human hybrids. But to a fan like me, I'm like, it's Openshaw! Yeah. That's just like the coolest little wink!
I gotta say, I completely missed that one. Completely missed that.
This is where I'm going full nerd again, George. I apologize.
No, that's perfectly fine.
It's just, I love the little detail.
Yeah, and it makes you immediately think that, you know, either the author is herself a real fan, or she's really good at research.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Whatever it is, Cammy, if you're listening, it's great, okay?
Because, oh, indeed. Indeed.
It really does add, even though, as you say, George, and I agree, that you can read this as a standalone thing, it really adds that level of, for an X-Files fan, it's that just level of continuity, which someone like me loves. You know, I love to see that.
That really is the epitome of tie-in writing, isn't it? It's trying to produce something which stands alone, yet also, you know, ties into the history of the show that you're writing.
Yeah, it really is. And given that Jonathan Mayberry has stated on the podcast, actually, that these books are canon and are considered canon by Chris Carter and by Fox, it really pleases me that the details add up. That's what I love. Even it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of the world, but considering The X-Files is my favourite TV show in the world and I love the mythology and I love the characters, to see this and think, oh, that makes sense, that adds up, that's, you know, I love that. I just love that.
Yeah, it's good to see that amount of care being taken with a project like this, because, you know, it really would have been very easy to have just, you know, knocked these books off and not really, you know, cared about the details and just done the cash-in thing. Would have been very easy to do that. So I'm very, very pleased that they did take the care with these books that they did.
There's only one, I think, that I was a little worried about. And that was one scene at the end where Mulder is talking to the Major about the Eternal Champion and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the Major tells him the story about El Rico Air Force Base, which is directly referencing the events we saw in One Son in the sixth season, which was the original point where the Syndicate were going to give up the Earth to the alien colonists. Mm-hmm. And he actually tells Mulder about the Cigarette Smoking Man. He uses those words. He says, the Cigarette Smoking Man did this. My only problem with that is that it's a little bit on the nose. That was my only issue. I read that thinking, I don't know if they should have done that. But then it's redeemed almost immediately after when you find out that the killer's name, Earl Ray Props, is a direct link to a line that was in the very beginning of the pilot, which is where Scully mentions how when they ask her, what do you know about Fox Mulder, when the FBI ask her that, and she says, he helped to catch Monty Props in 1988. That was in the very first line of the pilot, and they use Monty Props as potentially the recurring villain, or one of the recurring villains. And I was like, oh, Cammy, brilliant. That's so good.
I got to say, that reading that, I was assuming that he would then show up in a sequel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where they're going with it, potentially. But yeah, that's set. But according to X-Files lore, Monty Props is one of the big cases that Mulder takes on when he joins the FBI eventually. It sounds like it's heading towards that, but it's those little things that just set me on fire, really. It was just fantastic, alongside the characterization and, you know, things like Mulder's psychology about Samantha. Did you think that was worked in very well with how his feelings about Samantha are processing?
Yeah, how he's dealing with it or not dealing with it, as the case may be. They rang true.
Yeah, I mean, it really sort of got to the core of his character, didn't it, really?
Yeah, so much depends on that one incident in his life. It's kind of, it's the defining moment of his character, really, isn't it?
Yeah, all his life is framed around that, you know, and around that moment, and it informs everything he does and all of his psychology and his determination to find these children, you know, and find Sarah Lowe, the girl who's still missing. And, you know, and he does this all through the show. He does this. There's so many episodes where he projects Samantha onto cases like Conduit or Oubliette, or, you know, so, or Paper Hearts, or which is, you know, one of the big influences, I think, for this book. There's so many episodes where that happens. And this is the first one. This is the first case that he does this with. So it's perfect origin story, really. But then there was also, I mean, what did you think of the actual case itself? Like the little details about the bird and the...
The bird and the bone arrows.
The arrows made of...
Bone, yeah. Yeah, look, I thought that that was really interesting, the whole nature of a serial killer and the ritualization of the murders and stuff. I thought that was an interesting element to have in the book, and I liked the fact that they had these ritualistic elements to it, but they didn't turn out in the context of the story to be supernatural. So I liked that. As I said at the beginning, that I liked the fact that Mulder's story was not a supernatural story, and yet it was Scully's that had the supernatural elements. I thought that was a nice flip, and I liked the way they did that.
Yeah, it's not the traditional way, that you would naturally do it. And this is more, I think they did this partly because, I can't speak for Devil's Advocate yet, but I think they did it for this because before the X-Files, Mulder's journey was very much as a criminal profiler. You know, he was one of the FBI's greatest criminal profilers, with his photographic memory, which is mentioned several times in this, and how he was able to catch killers. And he was are you familiar with the spin-off series Millennium?
I only ever watched a couple of episodes of that, so I don't know it in any depth. No.
Well, the lead character in that, Frank Black, played by Lance Henriksen, is that, basically. That whole series is effectively what Mulder was before he found the paranormal and the X-Files, really. So I think the fact they did this sort of is more suggestive of the first part of his career before he discovers the paranormal and the X-Files, and then that's where we meet him originally. And I think that was part of the choice, and I thought they did that really well.
Yeah. I mean, indeed. I mean, the whole thing with Mulder handing over his, you know, handwritten notes profiling, you know, the killer's accomplice and stuff sort of leads in that direction. So there,
it's him taking that leap, isn't it? It's him doing that classic Mulder thing of taking that leap that a lot of other people can't do, and then, you know, going down that road. I really liked as well how it ended, not with the big confrontation with the killer, but with him at the FBI.
Yes,
I liked that a lot.
Yes, I did too. Again, you know, it's kind of like foreshadowing what's to come. With him joining the bureau and stuff, and it leading him in that direction, and the whole thing with the, you know, the choice of university and him getting the advice that Oxford is the place to go if he wants to join the FBI and stuff. Well, that was good.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was a subversion. You know, normally these things would build up to the final, oh, he's facing the killer and, you know, he's in danger and all this, but no, it didn't do that, and I really appreciated that.
Because I half expected, you know, them to be, you know, meeting the accomplice in the last chapter or something.
Yeah.
And I was, me too, at first. Yeah, because I was reading that and thinking, oh my God, they haven't left much room for that. Oh, I hope they don't, I hope they don't rush it too much, because that's going to be a real disappointment if they rush this and then get there and go, oh, they didn't do it. Oh, phew. Actually, that's good. I'm glad they didn't.
But this is it. That's the beauty of using Monty props, because we never knew anything else about that character except that one line that Scully says. That was it. So you've got an entire backstory that you can flesh out in these books about who Monty props was. And in this case, he's the so-called eternal champion, the law, as opposed to the chaos, with the chaos magic and all of that mythology from the Michael Moorcock book. Which again was really well thought out, I thought. That was a great lot of lore, wasn't it? For a psychology of a killer.
I want to read that book now.
Yeah. Same. It's really cleverly done in giving the killer that kind of twisted, weird psychology you saw actually in Millennium, and you see nowadays in stuff like Hannibal, the TV show, which, you know, has all of these very sort of grand, strange, eccentric killers. And that's the kind of thing that Mulder was hunting before he found the X-Files. So I love that. It all speaks to the knowledge and the understanding of Mulder's history and the show's history and things like that. So I thought that was terrific. So yeah, all in all, I mean, it's just a really good book, and it touches all the different areas in Mulder's life, I think. Finally then, George, would you say this is, given you've read both, would you say this is a better book or as not quite as good or better than Devil's Advocate? Which one would you? It's a tricky one. Which one would you say is the best, or would you put them together?
That's really difficult because they're two sides of the coin, aren't they? And they're very different books. You know, it's interesting. I expected, I guess, to like the Scully one better because I like Scully so much as a character. In the end, I think I preferred Agent of Chaos, just marginally. That's not to put Devil's Advocate down in any way because it's an excellent book in its own right. And again, it does what Agent of Chaos does as well in terms of being really good as a standalone as well as part of the X-Files history. And look, it might simply come down to the fact that, I was a teenage boy once upon a time. So being in the mind of a teenage boy with this book kind of connected with me more than being in the mind of a teenage girl. Which obviously I've never been, so maybe that's the reason. Because I can't really, because they're equally well written, they're equally well versed in the history of the X-Files. They're both terrific books, and yet I connected slightly more with Agent of Chaos. So there you go.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if I find the same. Yeah, I can completely understand that. It'd be interesting to see if I find the same experience with that, but. We'll find out in about a month, at which point we we talk about Devil's Advocate on the podcast.
Yeah, so it's also really interesting that, you know, it's the male author who's gotten into the head of the teenage girl and the female author who's gotten into the head of the teenage boy. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, it came about because of, and she mentions it briefly in the back of the book, but Jonathan Mabry talks about it on the podcast, how she wrote a short story for one of the previous anthologies, which was called Black Hole Sun, which was about Mulder as a teenager, and that's where the idea leapt off to do a book about it. So
yes, because I've read all the anthologies, and yes, Black Hole Sun does ring a bell as being one of the ones I really liked.
This is it. That was the genesis of it. So it came, and I think Jonathan just couldn't resist saying, well, let me do a Scully one. Let me do that. Because he's a big fan of Scully as well. I remember him talking to me about that. So, they chose well. They chose very well, and it's a really good book. It's a really good book. So, if you have listened to this, guys, and you haven't read Agent of Chaos, what are you doing? Firstly, but you need to, because we've just ruined it all for you now. But go back and give it a read, definitely, because it's great, and it's great to see the X-Files getting a novel. You know, two novels, right?
Yes.
It's been years since we've had novels, so it's great.
And I hope this is the beginning of lots more.
Totally. I think if the sales go well and they get their way, there will be plenty more, definitely. So that's very exciting. So that's The X-Files Origins, Agent of Chaos. But before we go, I'm going to talk to George about his contribution to The X-Files, which obviously is in the, as I said at the top of the podcast, the Secret Agendas anthology, which came out at the end of last year, which was the third anthology from IDW Publishing, edited by Jonathan Mabry. And George, you wrote a story called An Eye for an Eye.
Yes, I did.
Which, I genuinely thought was great. It's a short story, but it really, and we did a review on the XCast blog a couple of months ago, and I gave that an 8 out of 10. There you go. That's the that number again. Because I thought it was great. And it's a really creepy story, which sees Mulder and Scully encountering one of the ickiest, and I mean this in a good way, ickiest monsters I've read or seen on the show.
Well, thank you very much, because I was aiming for icky.
It was so icky.
As I said before, my favourite sort of X-Files episodes dealt with that monster of the week and the one that may or may not be real, that you never are quite sure. So that's the vibe that I was aiming for.
And you definitely got it. You definitely got it. So just I know we did an interview with you on the blog as well, but do you want to just talk about how you got involved in Secret Agendas again?
It was through the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers that it that it all happened. You know, I said before that my background is in writing for mostly children and occasionally teenagers, and I only do a bit of grown-up stuff. But tie-in writing, I guess, has been something that I have aspired to for a long time, mostly because I'm a fanboy who watches all this remarkably large amount of television, and I get very excited about it. So tie-in writing is something that I've been really wanting to get into more, and I had an opportunity back in 2008 to do a Doctor Who story for a Doctor Who anthology. And I also did some tie-in writing here for an Australian kids non-fiction series called Behind the News. So having done that allowed me to join the International Association of Media Tie-in Writers, which is a professional group, and you need to have had tie-in stuff published in order to become a member. So I became a member and, you know, kept my ear to the ground looking for opportunities, and then lo and behold, one day on the news group, there came up a message from Jonathan saying that he had a couple of spots open up in the last of the X-Files anthologies. Now, and you already knew about the X-Files anthologies because they'd been mentioned on the news group beforehand, and in fact, I think I had actually emailed Jonathan beforehand with, you know, one of these sort of like little fanboy emails saying, "Oh, if you ever get an opportunity for more writers, I'd really love to write the X-Files," sort of thing. Which I got a very polite email saying, "No, sorry, there are no opportunities at the moment, but you know, thanks for your interest," sort of thing. Yeah. And yes, yeah, so then when this message showed up saying that he had a couple of spots open up in the final anthology, and you know, people send me some pictures, he said. So yeah, I immediately started thinking about it and writing down ideas, and ended up sending in two pictures actually. And yeah, then you know, I sent them in not actually really expecting to get through, because there were only two spots open. And I figured every man and his dog would be pitching for this. And so, you know, when the email showed up in my inbox, I thought, oh, there's my rejection. And then I opened it up and my jaw dropped. It's like, oh, my God. Oh my God, he's chosen one of my pictures. It was so exciting. And, you know, it gave me the excuse to go and buy X-Files DVDs and tax deduct them, which is always a lovely, always a lovely thing to do.
Even better, even better. So when you were thinking about what story you would tell, was an eye for an eye there straight away? What was the inspiration for telling this kind of story? I mean, you mentioned obviously those kind of icky standalones, but was there anything that you'd had in your pocket for years, or anything you had that you wanted to use?
No, this was something completely new. It's not something that, you know, I pulled out of an old notebook or anything. It was me starting, first of all, to think about creatures and what sort of creature, because I could use, you know, I have this thing about eyes. I'm squeamish about eyes. I don't like being, like, you know, touched near my eyes and stuff, which was very awkward, because I also have a background in acting. And so, of course, you know, the first thing you do when you show up on set is you sit up in the makeup chair and the makeup person starts touching you around the eyes and like putting eyeliner and stuff like that, which is like, yes, for a person who's squeamish about eyes, that's actually really difficult. I grit my teeth and sit there. Anyway, So I thought, eyes, I will go with eyes. I need a monster that's like, you know, sucks out people's eyeballs or something like that. And then the next thing that happened was that the biblical quote popped into mind, an eye for an eye. And I thought, okay, I think I can work with this. So I need a monster that sucks out eyeballs, and I need some sort of biblical connection. And, yeah, it just kind of all developed from there. My mother-in-law is an Anglican priest. Well, she's retired now, but she was an Anglican priest. So the first thing I did was actually I sent her an email saying, "So, mother-in-law dear, Bible, eyeballs, send me to the right places." And she did. I'm sure she was a little baffled by it at first. I did explain. I never did give her a copy of the story. I wasn't sure that it would be her cup of tea. So.
Never know, she might have loved it.
This is what I did with your biblical quotes. Have a read of this.
Yeah, that was what was really great about it. You know, you managed to get a lot of different things in there. You know, you got the idea of religious overtones. You got the suggestions of historical child abuse that might have been a causal factor for the villain. You even got in, and I really like this, given it was set mid-90s. You got in a homosexual couple, and that's not something you saw a lot of on The X-Files back when it was made. So there were lots of nice little things I thought made this story stand out, you know, and really have those little moments of characterization, I think, which are hard to find in a short story.
And I tried to sort of like, you know, get in of the era stuff about X-Files as well. You know, one of the things that struck me about rewatching season one was that, you know, Mulder had slides for everything. Always slides. Come on, Scully, I'm going to show you some slides now.
He did love his slides, it's true, yeah. So, you know, that microfiche.
Yes. Yeah. So I had to get the slides in there, and, you know, the whole thing of, you know, the old brick-like mobile phones and pulling the antenna out and never having proper reception, you know. So those little sort of things got worked into the story, which was fun.
It was great. It's a really, really great little story. Which I'd encourage anyone to read. If you got the chance to do another one, and I've said to Jonathan, we need a fourth volume, you know, and he said it's not outside the realms of possibility. He did say it's a possibility. So if you got invited back, George, what would you do? Have you got another story idea that you wouldn't mind doing?
Oh, well, that's interesting, because I did actually pitch two ideas for that first, for this one. So Jonathan, you know, grabbed one of them, but there was another pitch. It was kind of riffing off, I guess, that first season episode with the gender fluid aliens.
Oh yeah, Gender Bender. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I liked that episode, but I felt there was a lot of things that it could have explored but didn't. So I thought I might like to use that idea of a gender fluid, possibly alien character that you never find out about exactly. So my idea for that one was to actually set it in during third season, and to go actually for, you know, the sort of feel that you had in the Cockroaches episode.
Very good.
That slightly tongue-in-cheek approach with a little bit of humor. So basically it was going to be about this mysterious FBI agent that Mulder has started dating. And it turns out that she is also the FBI agent that Scully's been dating. Except that she's a man when she's with Scully and a woman when with Mulder.
That would have been brilliant to read, I have to say.
And the whole gist of it was that he uses sex as a form of mind control. And he is trying to get a particular file wiped from the X-Files, and so needs to date Mulder and Scully in order to wipe their memories of that particular file.
Brilliant. I love that.
I would love a chance to write that. Would really, really love it. But, I don't know that, you know, if there was another anthology, I don't know that I would get the chance to pitch for it, because I'm guessing they would probably want some new writers to get their take on things. Secondly, it's an old pitch that I already pitched once before and wasn't accepted. So it's, you know, don't know that they'd want to revisit that. So chances are, if by some miracle there was a fourth anthology and I got the chance to pitch for it, I would resend that pitch, but I would also couple it with a brand new one as well. To give the choice.
Yeah.
I, as a writer, one of the things I like to do is overpitch. I view it as increasing my chances. So whenever I'm asked to pitch for a project, it's rare that I will just put in the single pitch. I will usually put in two pitches, and usually two very different pitches. So these two that I put in were very different, both in terms of storyline and tonally as well. So Yeah, yeah. You know, one lives in hope that one will get opportunities like this again. You know, I got to say that, you know, reading these X-Files origin books, I am so jealous of Jonathan and Cammy getting to write these sort of getting to write these sort of books, because, you know, it's not only X-Files, it's also young adults, so it's an area that I love, as well as a TV show that I love. So yes, very jealous in the professional author sort of jealousy sort of way, you know, like, oh, it's cool that they got, not in the, you know, gouging their eyes out with a blunt fork sort of jealousy, not that sort of jealousy, okay? Just want to make that clear.
Not an eye for an eye. We don't want that. But I'm, do you know what? I'm going to consider the fact you've told us about your gender fluid alien story an exclusive for the X-Cast there, George, because that may never appear in word in print, so I'm gonna probably, that's a little coup for us there.
Ah, well, there you go. So who knows? You never know. I might take that idea and use it in an original story, non-X-Files one.
So that's it. That brings us to the end of this episode covering Agent of Chaos and talking about your work, George. So, once again, a huge thanks for coming on. It's been really great to talk to you and,
absolute pleasure.
Chat through this book with you.
I enjoyed it a great deal. Any excuse to talk about these sort of things, I love. I love to do the whole fanboy chat.
Until you're back on then, at some point in the future, where can people find what you're up to? Online, where have you got a website, on social media, anything like that?
I do all sorts of social media and stuff, but you can find everything linked to from my website, which is just georgeivanoff.com.au. Don't forget that little AU at the end, because I'm in Australia!
Ah, yes. that's fantastic. Yeah, that's a great central hub. To check out everything George is up to. Make sure, guys, if you haven't bought the X-Files Secret Agendas, you go out and do that. It's available now from IDW Publishing. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it everywhere. I'm sure a lot of you have already read all the stories in there, but make sure you do, because it's terrific. If you all buy one, guys, we might get a fourth. So, you know, get on that.
yes, buy more! Buy more!
As ever, you can find us at the X_cast on Twitter, the X-Cast group and page on Facebook. If you type in the X-Cast podcast Facebook group, we're on there. There's loads of members, lots of chat going on, so make sure you get yourselves in there. You can email us at thexfcast@gmail.com, which quite a few of you have done in the past, which is great. Keep your feedback coming. Let us know if you want to get in touch. And we're also on iTunes, so if you go on there and leave us a review and a rating, that'd be even better, because we'll be able to get more known amongst the X-Files family and fandom. So, it all will help towards my goal one day of getting David and Gillian on the show, George. I think I can do that one day. That's the ultimate long-term
goal. Oh,
that would
be cool, wouldn't it? That would be so cool.
Well, they did pop up on Kumail Nanjiani's The X-Files Files very briefly once. Mm-hmm. He's obviously been on the show, so he's got a bit of a leg up than me. But, you know, I live in hope. So we'll be back very soon for a brand new episode. But until then, just remember the immortal words, trust no one. The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter @IAmWillAYE.